A rich American girl goes to England where she meets and marries an English lord with an amazing house and a cash flow problem. That's the true story at the core of the hit TV series Downton Abbey. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Julian Fellowes, the creator of Downton Abbey, has described Cora Crawley, Lady Grantham, as the mother of the series. Once he conceived of her character, the rest of the world bloomed around her. This hour, I'll talk about Downton Abbey with Jessica Fellowes, the niece of the creator and the author of two books about the series, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The television series Downton Abbey takes place on a fictional country estate in Yorkshire and focuses on the lives of the Earl and Countess of Grantham, their daughters, family, and those who serve them. First airing on ITV in Britain and then on PBS's Masterpiece Theatre, the show has captured the imagination of millions of viewers. In the very first episode, the future of the fictional family is thrown into question by a very real tragedy, the sinking of the Titanic.
Neither of them were picked up, that's what he said.
Mr. Crawley and Mr. Patrick?
That's what he said. Her ladyship was the colour of this cloth.
Well, it's a terrible shame if it's true.
It's worse than a shame. It's a complication.
Well, what do you mean?
What do you think? Mr. Crawley was his lordship's cousin and heir to the title.
Well, but I thought Lady Mary was the heir.
She's a girl, stupid. Girls can't inherit. But now Mr. Crawley's dead and Mr. Patrick was his only son. So what happens next?
It's a dreadful thing.
With me today is Jessica Fellowes. She is a journalist and the author of two books about the series, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She is also the niece of Julian Fellowes, the creator of the series, and she will be in Iowa today. She'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Hello, Jessica.
Hello, hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back to the inspiration for this series. Julian Fellowes, your uncle, was the writer of the Oscar-winning movie Gosford Park, which was released in 2001. And that was a movie that explored a lot of this same territory. Was it his work with Gosford Park that led to Downton Abbey?
Yeah, it was, actually. It was, absolutely. I mean, he was having dinner with a television producer, Gareth Neame, who is now the executive producer of Downton Abbey, and they were trying to get some other TV show off the ground. It just wasn't really working, and they were just chatting, and Gareth said, you know, I'd really like you to revisit the Gosford Park territory for a television show. He could see how, if you had the scope and the time of a whole season, you know, you could be exploring all of those different people and relationships. But Gosford Park was the thing that had really turned Julian's life upside down. I mean, he'd won the Oscar and just elevated himself, you know, to another level altogether. And he said he felt that to go back to that would be like asking lightning to strike in the same place twice. So he sort of said no, he wouldn't do that. But then he went home and he happened to be reading a book called How to Marry an English Lord, which is a great book by Carol Wallace and Gail McCall. And it's all about the American buccaneers who went over to England in the 1890s for about the next 50 years onwards and married into the aristocracy. And he said he sort of got him thinking about what would it be like to be one of those women, those heiresses who'd gone over and married into a very different kind of world and left behind their lives in, you know, could be Virginia, could be Wisconsin, could be Iowa, and then find themselves 20 years later in this very cold castle in Yorkshire. And so that was the beginning of the show. That was Cora. And then after that, I think all the ideas came thick and fast.
He has said that Cora is really the mother of the series for him.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, it is a period that both Julian and I have always had an interest in. I think, you know, partly just because we have an interest in our own family, and my grandfather, Julian's father, was born in 1912, so which is the year the season opens when the Titanic sinks. So he was born into that world. So for us, although it is a historical period, it's also, it's very real. You know, it concerns people who were not that far back.
Let's talk a little bit about these buccaneers, because I think that's a part of history that not a lot of us are really familiar with. And these were young women.
Young women. I mean, they tended to be rich heiresses. And I think what you had in America at that time is a situation where you had these very old families that had settled, you know, kind of families that had gone over on the Mayflower and were really rather grand. And it was very difficult to penetrate this kind of very upper-class society, you know, in certain circles. And what would happen is that you would get these families that made a lot of money very quickly, but they were considered to be cowboys. And they were not allowed to kind of get into these very desirable societies. And so the more ambitious mothers decided that maybe if they could get their daughters a title, they might get better accepted back home. So they came over, and the English aristocracy was very happy to welcome them, because at that time the English aristocracy did not have a lot of money. There'd been an agricultural depression and there was a very steep rise in taxes. And so they were very happy to welcome these rich, pretty Americans to the party. And also King Edward VII really liked American girls. He'd come over to America and he'd had a great time, and he was really happy to kind of make sure they were looked after when they went over to England. So that really was how it all started, you know. And so, I mean, American women did very well, and we have a lot to thank them for. Of the very first female MP to sit in the House of Commons, in the British House of Commons, you know, as a member of the government, was an American, Lady Astor.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned how American society was closed to these nouveau rich.
Yeah.
In our impression, it seems like British society would have been extremely difficult to penetrate.
No,
how did these girls get into the right circles to meet the landed gentry?
Well, it was actually, oddly enough, it was sort of quite a straightforward process. I actually think the American upper classes are much more rigid than the British in lots of ways. And I mean, but what you would have is every summer, you have the summer season in London. And this is when the debutantes would be introduced to society. So these would be girls of about 17 or 18, and they would be presented to the king or queen at court. And then thereafter, there would follow, you know, sort of endless parties and sports and, you know, sort of racing at Ascot and boating at Henley and all that. And, you know, sort of all the grand families around the country would settle in London for that period. And it was basically a kind of like a huge dating scene. It was, you know, the idea was that you would find your husband, you know, in that circle, because they wanted people to marry for love, but they just wanted their daughters to fall in love with the right people. And so the best way of doing that was getting them at the right parties. So the American girls, all they had to do was demonstrate that they were the daughters of, you know, a sort of respectable profession. So if they're fathers had made money in, you know, opening a department store or property or something like that, that would be absolutely fine. And you just had to find somebody who would introduce you to the court so that you could be presented as a debutante. And there were women who were prepared to do that for money.
So you could pay your way in.
So you could actually pay your way in, yeah.
And there was one specific woman who took this route that inspired Julian Fellowes in particular, right?
Mary Leiter. Yeah, she was very beautiful, and she was the daughter of an extremely ambitious mother. And she came over to Europe. Initially, she didn't do terribly well, actually, and then, you know, the mother couldn't quite work out where her daughter wasn't getting married off quick enough. And then they came over to England, and she still wasn't doing that great. And then she had one day where she met a duchess, a former prime minister, and the Prince of Wales, who was later King Edward VII. And then after that, she went to a ball that the Prince of Wales was at, and he asked her to dance the first dance. And after that, she was kind of made, and she was, you know, introduced into society, and everybody loved her. And she fell madly in love with a man called George Curzon, who was a rather broke aristocrat. And he resisted marrying her for a long time because he didn't want to be seen as a gold digger. Because a lot of these men, you know, it was not necessarily a very nice thing to do, marry a rich American heiress, you know, who you weren't in love with. You know, it wasn't seen to be a very seemly thing. And he resisted, but she was madly, madly, madly in love with him. And anyway, eventually, it took years, eventually he did marry her. And they had quite a short marriage, really. They had sort of a 10-year marriage. She died, but she died the highest-ranking American that has ever lived as Viceroy of India. So she had a happy ending, really, in the end.
Well, an early happy ending, I guess.
Yeah. So, an early happy ending, yeah.
So once a woman like Cora would have married into this family, and that's kind of the backstory that Julian Fellowes created for this couple, that they married for her money.
Yeah.
Robert married her for her money, but did then fall in love with her
as well. They did then fall
in love,
yeah. And, so, you know, she lucked out. She had a nice man.
Once a woman like Cora would marry into a family like this, what would she do all day? What would her role be?
I know. Well, she would have found it very difficult. I mean, you know, we see, I mean, you know, at the beginning, her mother-in-law, Violet, the Dowager Countess, you know, was not inclined to make life easy for her. Her real purpose was to produce an heir. And, of course, this is something that Cora has failed to do, and by only having three daughters. And it was always seen as the woman's fault in those days. And, of course, your mother-in-law, by definition, had always managed to produce a son. So she always had one over on you, and, you know, in that respect. So, you know, so that would have made life quite difficult for her. And then, you know, other than that, I mean, it was, you know, her duties would have been to just, you know, keep that house happy and entertain whoever Robert needed to entertain. They spent a lot of time before the war taking their clothes off and putting them back on again.
Well,
I mean, they
actually
changed their outfit.
Right, give us a little bit of a rundown of that, because they would change clothes 4 times a day?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, once you were married, you were allowed to have breakfast in bed. So that at least sort of abstained you from having to dress for breakfast. But the unmarried girls had to get dressed for breakfast. And then you would probably change to go for a walk, or you would certainly at least change for lunch. You know, you might need to change for a different kind of afternoon activity if you went riding, or, if you were going into town or whatever. And then at about 5 o'clock, you would change into a tea gown, which was another kind of elaborate sort of dressing gown, really. And then you would change into your evening clothes. But, of course, the clothes then were just very complicated. And it wasn't so much, you know, it's not just the corsets, which would be hooked into by your lady's maid. But, you know, just they were just very elaborate, kind of endless layers. But it did take up their time. I mean, it was a way of passing the time. And I read a book about Consuela Vanderbilt, who was an American heiress who married the Duke of Marlborough. And she wrote a book called The Glitter and the Gold, which is very interesting for an American take on marrying into that life. She describes a shooting party that she had, and she said it was 4 days long, and she had to have 16 different dresses. Every woman had to have 16 dresses for a 4-day weekend.
Oh my. I'm talking with Jessica Fellowes. She is the author of 2 books about Downton Abbey, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She's speaking at Iowa State University tonight in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 8 o'clock about the women of Downton Abbey. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the show Downton Abbey, a show that has captivated millions of viewers around the world, having been shown on ITV in Britain and on PBS's Masterpiece Theater. And with me today is Jessica Fellowes. She is the author of 2 books about Downton Abbey, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She is also the niece of the creator of the series Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes. And before the break, Jessica, we were talking about Cora, the mother of this family, and really the inspiration for this series. Obviously, being inspired by a real person to create the character of Cora, there are also many other real pieces of history that go into creating this world of Downton Abbey. And we talked about how it started off with the sinking of the Titanic. Let's play another clip from the show where the daughter, Sybil, the youngest of the 3 girls, is beginning to really encounter the world of politics.
Last June saw Emily Davison crushed to death beneath the hooves of the King's horse.
Will the summer of 1914 prove as fatal for the hopes of women? It cannot! This historic violence the first step of the journey to women's equality.
If you're so keen on women's rights, let a woman speak.
Well, why stop there? Let's get the dogs up and listen to them.
You all right, Malin?
Isn't it exciting?
Sybil, I think it's time for Branson to take you home.
Not yet.
I think so. I applaud your spirit in coming and I will applaud your discretion when you leave.
But you agree with everything he says.
I do, my dear, but I also know if anything happens to you, Branson will lose his place.
Better safe than sorry, m'lady.
The car's just here.
Women must get the vote, mustn't they, Branson? Why does the Prime Minister resist the inevitable?
Politicians can't often recognise the changes that are inevitable.
That's a moment from the series Downton Abbey when the youngest daughter, Sybil, goes to a rally for women's suffrage. And, of course, she is driven by the chauffeur, Branson, who plays a very important role in the series as time goes on. But I'm curious about all of the real events that get rolled into this show and how much attention is paid to making sure that they are as they were.
Oh, I think every bit of attention is paid. I mean, Julian is very knowledgeable about that period himself anyway. And then the production go to extraordinary lengths to make sure everything is as authentic as, you know, as possible. I mean, I know Julian has a very strong belief that if you're going to do it, if you're going to mind, if you're going to care, then you have to get it absolutely right all the way through, you know. So, but I think the thing is that it's, you know, it is a fascinating period. You can't miss out those keynotes sort of events, as it were. It was a, you know, it was a period of great change and great excitement, and we see in season one, as we've discussed, as, you know, opens in 1912. The reason they open it with the sinking of the Titanic is really because that was just such a quick point of reference for everyone to understand. You know, you hear Titanic and you can immediately think to yourself, okay, I know what clothes that was. I know what kind of, you know, attitudes were going on then. You know, you can kind of get yourself straight into the picture. And then by the end of season three, we've got to 1922, which is 10 years later. And so much happened in that decade. And, you know, you had the First World War, obviously, but, you know, it was the war that escalated. A lot of change that had been beginning to rumble up to that point. So suddenly there was a massive escalation in the development of medicine, for example, technological development in arms, which meant aeroplanes, too. It affected society and its structure. You had female suffrage. You know, so there was, you know, there was a lot, and it moved very fast, and I think it felt very exciting, but also quite overwhelming. And, you know, so how the characters respond to that makes for a very good storyline. It affects all of their relationships, and I think it is something that we should understand. I think we do understand maybe at a subconscious level. It's why we like the program, because in the last 10 years, we've gone through a lot of change ourselves as well. You know, if you think back to 2003, that's pre-Google, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, pre-reading online, pre-Botox for all, pre-gay marriage. You know, I mean, we think and organize ourselves with a different framework to 10 years ago. And again, it's very exciting and sometimes a bit overwhelming. You're not always sure if you're making the right choices. So I think, you know, it's quite nice for us to sort of see them. We're looking, we enjoy the escapism and the beauty and the costumes and all the rest of it. And at the same time, we're fascinated by what they're going through because they set the foundations of where we are today.
I can imagine that the series plays a little bit differently in Britain. But looking at women's suffrage in Britain, that's something that not a lot of Americans know a lot about. If we know about women's suffrage in the United States, it's a little bit different story. Also, I think that really for many people, World War One and the history of that war was really largely eclipsed by World War Two. I mean, when we're taught about history, that's the war that's focused on, at least here. Is there an awareness among people on the set and who are writing that people are actually learning their history from watching this show?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think, you know, they have a historical advisor who's employed by the production, you know, to help the cast understand what was different. And, you know, there are small details, like a man would never stand around with his hands in his pockets, for example, you know, would always rise from the chair when a woman came into the room. And, you know, so you've got those kind of small details. And then also the historical advisor you know, definitely talk to the men about what it was like to go to war at that time, and you know, the responses that they would have had from everybody when they got back home again, and explaining all of that. You know, I mean, it was, I think it was different to the States, in that the States, although they did get involved towards the end of that war, not as nearly as closely as they did in the Second World War, and Britain definitely had its heart ripped out by the First World War. I mean, it lost, you know, an entire generation of its young men, and it left 2 million women more than men in the population afterwards. And that, you know, they had this, what they called the problem of surplus women, where they were sort of suggesting that these women get shipped off to the colonies in order to find husbands and things. So, you know, so it was very different for America and England at that time. And we do see that reflected, I think, a little bit when we have Martha, Cora's mother, played by Shirley MacLaine, come over to this, to the show, because she. She's Violet's contemporary, but she looks very different. You know, she's embracing the future. She's, you know, she's prepared to make change. She thinks that's a good thing. And, you know, and it is that theme of kind of change bringing good that takes them into the 1920s.
The characters that you profile in your books, you also talked, of course, to the actors who played those characters, and you incorporate some interviews with those actors in your book. And I was struck by the number of times the actors in your interviews would reference the historical lessons that they had been taught before performing. I mean, it almost sounds like that is almost as important as the director's notes.
I think it is. You know, you want to understand. I mean, that's why it's important to get the costume right. You know, you've got to wear a corset because you need to understand how it felt for a woman then to sit and stand and breathe in that way. You know, and men have the sort of stiff collars, and, you know, it affects everything, and have all the right props. And I mean, the art department are extraordinary in that they, you know, if you see a letter, even just for a moment on the screen, that letter will be written on the right kind of paper with the right ink and the right sentiments, you know, and all the rest of it, which is one of the reasons I'm really pleased about the book, because we get to reproduce those things, you know, so they can be seen for all posterity. They don't just flash by in a second. But, yeah, no, the actors used to read a lot. I mean, Mrs. Patmore's actress, Leslie Nichols, said that she read about, you know, what it was like to be a cook then, and she said when she understood that a cook was working in that kitchen, which would be very hot in the basement of the house, it would be fairly airless, fairly windowless, you know, she'd be cooking not just six meals a day, which is three for the family, three for the servants, but every single thing in that house had to be made from scratch, every condiment, every sauce, every bread or pastry. And she said, you understand why they get so bothersome and cross. And she said, but you also understand why it really mattered, because they were sort of felt responsible for the reputation of the house. They felt they had to put on a really good show, and that's why everyone really gets behind it and works so hard.
Well, and we've talked quite a bit about the people who live upstairs so far, so let's move the conversation downstairs, and let's listen to an exchange between Mrs. Patmore and the maid, Daisy.
Is your fire still in?
Yes, Mrs. Patmore.
Oh, no, I will. One does never cease. Have you laid the service all breakfast?
Yes, Mrs. Patmore.
I'm finished blocking that stove.
Yes, Mrs. Patmore.
What about the bedroom fires?
Oh, Mrs. Patmore.
Right, we'll take the things and get started on the fires on the ground floor.
An exchange between Daisy and Mrs. Patmore. And in your book, you create a list of what Daisy's day would be like. And you don't have to tell us all of it.
No, but we'd be here for another 3 hours.
Right, right. We'd be almost as tired as she would be. But give us an idea of what the life of a maid. And Daisy's character is sort of three maids rolled into one, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, just from a narrative point of view, it just is better to kind of was better to put it all into one. She's probably, in that sense, she's probably the only one whose character has that kind of a compromise, because you would have different maids. You would have a kitchen maid who would be assisting Mrs. Patmore with all of the vegetables, scrubbing and all of the washing up and you know, the pots and the pans and all the rest of it. And then you would have a stillroom maid who made all of the cakes and the scones and breads and got them ready for tea. And then you would have a maid who did all the sort of blacking of the stoves in the fireplaces. So we've got Daisy doing all of it. So it's a little bit it's a little bit of a long day for her. But she was, she would have also had, I mean, any maid at her end of the scale, that is the very bottom of the scale, would have had the worst day, and she would get up before anybody else in the house at sort of 5 or 6 in the morning. And then she goes around all of the bedrooms in the family and lights their fires so that they have a nice warm room when they wake up. And she goes downstairs, blacks the stove, and then she starts to get the servants all ready for their breakfast. So in a sense, you've got the servants who serve the family, and then there's servants who serve the servants. You know, there was a kind of another hierarchy going on. We don't see it so much in Downton Abbey, but there was one particular house at that time that had 60 servants, and 20 of them were servants for the senior servants, so all got very complicated. But I mean, Daisy would have a long day because she would be there until she did the final washing up. So she'd be sent to bed about 9:30 or 10, and they would get a bit of time off in the middle of the day. They would have a tea, and that was the servants' opportunity to put their feet up a little bit. I mean, they couldn't be worked all day, otherwise they wouldn't survive.
Well, and how much time off would they actually have?
They wouldn't have very much time off. I mean, they would have half a day off in a week. But the thing is, it's just the context, I suppose, of being a servant at that time. You obviously have better and worse houses that you could work in, but for a lot of those less senior servants, in rural areas particularly, the option was really to work in farming or to work in a house. And they always wanted to work in a house because even though with farming the money might be better and your time is more your own, it's much more unreliable and, it could be quite isolated. Whereas in a house, they got 3 meals a day, they were under a roof, they got a bed, they were protected, they had a kind of family in the sense that, they had all these other servants who were with them. And so you would be working hard, but you'd all be in it together. I mean, I'm not saying, it was like some dream life or something, but I don't think either it was as awful as we might feel, I think for them then. But again, at this time, just after the war, things are beginning to change. People are starting to feel that service isn't the best option, and all these different ideas are beginning to open up. Different careers are beginning to open up, and going to London and working in the department stores or becoming a secretary or working in journalism, newer ideas. And also movies were starting to be made, and you were getting these stories coming over from Hollywood and magazine articles about young girls who had, been discovered from sort of nowhere, becoming these huge stars, and it started to feed the fantasy, that maybe that could happen to them. But before that, you just wouldn't even think about that. You just thought, this is my life and this is how I'm going to live it. It didn't really sort of change. There was no way of knowing any better or worse.
Can you put in perspective for us, again, since as Americans watching this, we don't really know the British history at this time, what kind of poverty problems did Britain have at that time? Because poverty was rampant.
Yeah. There were enormous poverty problems, and I mean they were just beginning to introduce a sort of welfare state at that time. I mean, in 1911 we had the Health Act, which meant you could claim something if you were sick. Up to that point, if you were sick and you couldn't work, you didn't get wages. So it was very harsh. And then the government started to introduce sort of pensions and sort of benefits. It was a big, big issue. It was a big divide between the rich and poor.
And so those 3 meals a day, that was a really significant benefit for a lot of the people who made it into service.
Yeah, that was 3 meals a day that you weren't paying for. So, I mean, your wages were less, partly because you were getting board and lodgings, but you didn't really have to spend your wages on anything, whereas everybody else, would be carefully piecing out, sort of penny by penny what they had to pay on their rent or their food. So, yeah, it was a significant difference.
Well, and I was surprised to read, you wrote that these young women who went into service, who would enter in positions like Daisy's, would be young, and most of them would be out of service by the time they were in their early 20s because they would get married. Mm. But then you also wrote about how very difficult it was to have a romance when you were in service.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by that because it sounds like it would have been impossible to meet someone to marry.
Well, it sort of was. It sort of was. I mean, you kind of took your chances with the glimpses that you got. I mean, Mrs. Hughes, the housekeeper, as it were, and Carson, the butler, and their real-life counterparts were essentially the mother and father of the servant family below stairs, and they felt very responsible, you know, towards the morals of their charges, and that meant, you know, there was to be no relationships, you know, that it would, for anything apart from anything else, you know, when you were working so closely together, it would cause such complications of, you know, there were sort of relationships being made and broken all the time and things, you know. So, and also remember then, it was different, you know, there was no sex before marriage, you know, it was a very conservative time. Of course, stuff went on, but it wasn't the general thing. So I slightly bewildered as to how any of the maids managed to meet anybody, but I think, you know, maybe they managed to meet a gardener, or every now and again they managed to go to the village, you know, and chat to a post office boy or something. And that sort of would be their only opportunity. I mean, there were certain things, like there'd be dances at Christmas, and they would, you know, when the cinemas came on, they would do servants' screening times, you know, at 10 o'clock at night. And so there would be small opportunities to catch someone's eye.
I'm talking with Jessica Fellows. She is the author of two books about Downton Abbey, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She is going to be speaking tonight at 8 o'clock at the Memorial Union at Iowa State University about the women of Downton Abbey. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Jessica Fellows, and she has written two books about the television series Downton Abbey, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She also has some insider knowledge because she's also the niece of Julian Fellows, the creator of Downton Abbey. And before the break, we were talking about the life of servants. We were talking about what it would be like for a young girl to come into service like Daisy. And let's talk about Carson. He's another person in the series who is patterned off someone in the real world, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, on several, you know, sort of, I mean, butlers tended to stay in their households for a long time. You would work your way up, you know, and then they were very, very senior servants, and they pretty much shared the role of running the house with the master. And any sensible master would concede to his butler every now and again, you know, on a matter that meant, you know, his butler would be kept happy. And we do see sometimes, you know, little arguments between Robert and Carson, and where Carson will win. And everything does matter. I mean, people often say to me, kind of, oh, I love the scenes where, you know, Carson's getting himself into such a state about whether the right pudding glasses have gone on the, you know, on the table and things. And it is sort of funny to us. But the thing is, for someone like Carson, it was the purpose of his existence. You know, if he didn't mind about pudding glasses, which is what he had been employed to mind about, then he didn't really know what else he could do. You know, he wasn't going to be married. Butlers would really marry, maybe if they married at all, they would marry on retirement. And, you know, very, very rarely while they were working at Butler's, because if you were married, you'd have to live apart from your wife most of the time, you know.
Well, and you wrote that many little bed and breakfasts in England were staffed by former butlers and former heads of household staff that got married.
Yeah, you can see how it makes sense. They would often marry the housekeepers, you know. I mean, in lots of ways, the best way of understanding how a house like that ran is to look at a hotel. I mean, because they would, you know, particularly before cars, when people went to stay with them, you might go and have people come and stay with you who you don't know that well, but you just politically you think it might be advantageous, or someone's aunt has asked you to meet them or whatever. And, you know, because there aren't cars, they need to stay with you for quite a few days. And then you would, you know, if you were a very grand house, you would want to maintain a good reputation for being good hostesses, generous hostesses, you know, so you would lavish a lot of money and time and attention, you know, on putting on the right show.
In the show, there's Mrs. Patmore and Mrs. Hughes. Mrs. Hughes is the housekeeper, the head housekeeper, and Mrs. Patmore is in the kitchen. And I, as a viewer, I was wondering why they are called Mrs., because both of them are clearly unmarried. And again, that's something you address in the book. Why are they called Mrs.?
Well, it's just to give them a mark of respectability.
But it in no way means that they're married.
No, they weren't. I mean, they They almost certainly couldn't be. I mean, cooks, I have to say, cooks in a house like that were often men. There were female cooks, but they were often men. But Julian felt that he had enough male staff below stairs. He wanted another woman. But housekeepers, you know, I mean, you know, again, Mrs. Hughes, she does refer to the fact every now and again that she had not married, you know, in order to have a career. I think she's happy about that. I don't think we should necessarily feel sorry for her about that. You know, it meant something, you know, to have that kind of career. I mean, and to be a senior servant in a house like that was a very respectable and admired position. You know, you knew the ins and outs of a an earl and his family. You moved above and below stairs. You know, you met quite interesting people. You know, you had big responsibilities. And interestingly, they had a kind of servants underground network at that time, and you could get headhunted for a job in another big house. So you know, and they all knew who were good employers and who weren't. You know, so if you were an employer who wasn't paying anyone fairly or you know was being mean in some way, it would get whispered about on the grapevine. You would find it very hard to employ any servants. So that's another reason why masters have to be good to their servants.
And Mrs. O'Brien is another character who has that moniker of Mrs. as a sign of respect. And
she's Miss
O'Brien. I'm sorry. But she's another person who has chosen to make service her career.
Yeah. And I mean, you never quite know with someone like Miss O'Brien, with, you know, how much of an option she really had in her 20s. She's so sort of mean, you know. But
Julian Fellowes has said that she is based on someone that he knew.
Yeah, well, she was based on the lady's maid to a cousin of his grandfather's, who had a reputation amongst the family for being as polite as a courtier, but with a black heart. And she, you know, she apparently drove away every sort of member of the family and friend of her mistress's until she ruled their house herself. And her mistress died believing that everybody had betrayed her but her one faithful servant. But I think ladies' maids were in a very tricky position because they had a real intimacy with their mistress, you know, to the point where they were, you know, they were helping them dress and undress and bath and things, and they would, you know, they would be there at that end of the evening when a mistress is ready to kind of, you know, confide in what's happened that night or her marriage or something like that. You know, they would be privy to an awful lot of secrets. Yet their mistress probably didn't know an awful lot about them. You know, the questioning wasn't really quite such a two-way thing. And they would have nothing really to do with this knowledge. You know, they couldn't tell any of the other servants because they were so much more senior than them. And so I think maybe it sort of drove some of them to a manipulation because that was really all they could do.
The relationships between the people who are serving the house and the people who are upstairs in the house are some of the most fascinating relationships. But I was, in reading your books, surprised to discover that in filming the show, there is a disconnect between the servants' hall and upstairs just because of locations. These are filmed in completely different places.
They do. So, I mean, all the above stairs scenes are filmed in a house called Highclere Castle, which is not, in fact, in Yorkshire. It's kind of a couple of hours away from London. And as you see it on the screen, it's pretty much how it looks in real life. I mean, those are the paintings, those are the books, those are the rugs on the floor. The art department didn't have to do too much except put a few potted plants around and some personal items and things. And so all the above stairs scenes are filmed there. But even though it's still a very great and beautiful house, they no longer have the servants' quarters that they used to, because you just don't run your servants like that anymore, you know. So the set for Below Stairs is in Ealing Studios, which is a couple of hours away down the road. And it's the most wonderful set. I mean, it's all done in one piece, so you can walk from the servants' hall to the kitchen and so on. It's magnificent. But, of course, what it does mean is that the actors who are the servants below stairs and the actors who are the family above stairs tend not to see each other very often, just as they would have, you know, in real life. So I think that, you know, that definitely made it quite funny for them. And the actor who played Branson, the chauffeur, said that he really understood how his character felt, because he said when he had to do his first scenes in the dining room, you know, he felt as intimidated and as unused to the, you know, the surroundings as his, you know, as his character.
That must create some continuity challenges with you know, the dishes that Mrs. Patmore prepares and she hands over to the footman and they appear in the dining room,
two weeks later?
Yeah.
So it makes for a bit of a continuity issue, yeah.
And do they, is that real food? Are they actually preparing food that is put before the actors?
Yeah, they definitely do real food. I mean, the thing is that those dining room scenes take about 10 to 12 hours to film. And certainly, I mean, the actor Dan Stevens said to me, you know, you learn quickly not to chew chicken in a scene because otherwise you'll be having to chew it, you know, for 10 hours and doesn't taste very nice by the end of that day. And they definitely had problems where they filmed with a dish of lobster last summer and it was a really hot day. By the end of the day, it smelled really disgusting. And so it definitely is real. It definitely is real. But well, it's not always eaten.
You bring up Dan Stevens, and of course I'm not going to avoid talking
about. You're not
going to
blame me.
Well, I don't think it's your fault, is it? Is it? Of course, Dan Stevens is no longer on the show after season three, and that his character was done away with because he chose to leave the show. When he made that decision, what kind of a stir did that create among the family? I mean, I can imagine these actors get to be very close to one another.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, they're all actors, they understand, you know, you go where you feel your best opportunities lie. And I think, you know, Dan Stevens is getting offered, you know, a lot of exciting things. I think, you know, the thing for Julian was just that they felt that having spent, you know, what was essentially 10 years getting Matthew and Mary together, they couldn't then just have them simply separate. You know, really death could be the only thing that could tear that couple apart. So that was why Matthew had to get killed off.
And I know how upset people were in the United States. How upset were people in Britain when that happened?
Very upset. No, very upset. I was upset. I mean, I didn't know. We do something slightly differently in the UK, which is that we watch all but one episode. We start it in September and it finishes sort of the end of October, and then we see the season finale on Christmas Day. And so I had heard the rumors.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, I'd heard the rumors about Dan Stevens leaving, but I chose not to find out the truth behind them because I'm actually such a bad liar that I'd rather not hold a secret that I can't keep. So I didn't want Julian to tell me, yes, he definitely is leaving, and then to be asked, you know. So, anyway, and I thought, I'm sure he won't leave, you know, I'm sure he won't leave, you know, he'll stay. Anyway, so I watched it and then obviously saw the tragic ending and I texted Julian afterwards and said, you killed Matthew and on Christmas Day, that seems particularly brutal. So I'm sorry, you know.
In the foreword to one of your books, Julian Fellowes wrote about these grand houses and how, you know, obviously we're watching sort of the experience of one family as they try to hold on to this kind of life, which, as we all know, really disappeared.
Yeah.
And he writes about how these houses started to be sold off and torn down and ripped up in many ways. And then there was a moment where suddenly England said, wait a minute, this is a part of history that we care about.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, it took a long time because, I mean, in a funny sort of way, I mean, they started to believe that this life is over in the 1920s after the war. You have to remember that, you know, around Europe at that time, there were a lot of successful socialist and communist revolutions happening. And, you know, there were many people who expected this to happen at any moment to England and were kind of, you know, kind of not bothering to do up their houses because it could probably be stormed by the Bolsheviks, you know, any time now. Anyway, it didn't eventually happen. And then, on the other hand, you did have a lot of houses that did survive because the new money came and they wanted to demonstrate their wealth according to the trappings of old money. So they liked to buy these houses and run the servants and so on. But they became more and more expensive to maintain and it became more and more expensive to hire servants and also fewer servants wanted to actually, you know, do the job. And then the Second World War really kind of did away with it altogether. A lot of those houses got requisitioned by the army during the Second World War. And so when the families came back, they had been quite damaged. It would be too expensive to do them up. And they sort of thought, well, you know, our lives are different now. We can live in smaller houses. You know, we spend less money maintaining them. And, you know, what's the point? And they pulled down a lot of these houses, you know, and they pulled down all kind of the estates. Julian, as he was growing up in the 50s and 60s, said he remembers, you know, these houses kind of disappearing. And then suddenly in the 1970s, the V&A Museum, which is quite a big museum in London, staged a show about these old country houses, and it was extraordinary. It sort of just, for whatever reason, I think it caught the mood at the right time, and everybody said, oh, we're letting these amazing pieces of history disappear, you know, and all these beautiful pieces of architecture. And so everything started to change then, and also I think a lot of house owners then became a bit more commercially enterprising, you know, instead of sitting around thinking, oh, everything's just disappearing, they realized they could really do something with it, you know, and turned their houses into venues and charged tickets and started to rescue them in that way.
This period of time, starting in 1912, was a really difficult period of time for much of England. It was obviously a very good time for a select few who had the money and the means to live in this way. But as we touched on earlier, there was so much poverty,
yeah,
and there was so much pollution, and there was so much disease, and really so many difficulties with life during this time period. Why do you think this is a time period that viewers seem to be so drawn to? Why do we love to watch Downton Abbey?
Well, I mean, I think it is, as a, you know, it is very beautiful to watch. I mean, I think times are quite difficult for a lot of us now, you know, and I think it's a very nice piece of escapism. I think in many ways it represents a world where they sort of, you know, without actually wanting to go back to that, there's something you feel like there must have been something quite comforting in the fact they all seemed to know what their place was. They knew what their position was, what their role was, and how to kind of carry that out. And it looked like a very safe, comforting place to be. And I think it did in lots of ways. I think particularly before the war, I think it did feel like that for a lot of people. You know, someone like Violet, she very comfortably led her life in that way. She was not at all bothered by any outside influences or what anyone else thought. You know, she was doing what she felt was the most important thing, you know, which was keeping the family and the title and the estate going. But I think also, as I said, I think there are parallels with the modern age, you know, in terms of the fact that these changes were happening. And you know, it feels to me like those are the two bookends of 100 years that reflect each other the best, you know, in two very different ways. But, you know, we're going through a lot of change, a lot of excitement. You know, there are many similarities. And I think, you know, that maybe feels less conscious. To me, it's very obvious. And Julian very deliberately chose that period because he wanted it to be relevant to modern life, you know. So it is historical, but they do have telephones, they do have cars, they do have weekends, you know, they have jobs, they're trying to marry for love, you know, all of that. They, you know, they're gay and wondering how to deal with that, you know. So that was what he wanted to do. He didn't want it to be sort of candlesticks and heaving bosoms and the sort of Jane Austen things.
Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jessica Fellows is the author of two books about Downton Abbey, The World of Downton Abbey and The Chronicles of Downton Abbey. She is also the niece of Julian Fellows, the creator of Downton Abbey. And she'll be speaking at Iowa State University tonight at 8 o'clock in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.